Welcome to This Week in Impact, where Impact Alpha editor David Bank and I break down some of the most interesting impact investing stories of the week. I'm Brian Walsh. It's Thursday, May 16th. Today we'll discuss Biden's new Chinese tariffs and how they impact the global supply chain critical for the green transition, the Global Fund for Coral Reefs efforts to invest in the blue economy, and the value of all the invisible work women do to build resilient economies and fight climate change. That's all coming up on This Week in Impact. Hi, David. How's your week been going?
Oh, it's just great, Brian. The spring has sprung. The school year is coming to an end. We're getting ready for our son's high school graduation.
That's great news. Congratulations. You know, when I graduated high school, we had a family friend who sung a song, "Start Paying Taxes Right Now."
He already is. He's got a part-time job as a lifeguard and swim instructor at the YMCA. So he's gainfully employed already.
Oh, that's great. Well, speaking of taxes, let's talk tariffs, David, which is really just another word for taxes on imports. When he was president, Donald Trump countered several decades of what was a bipartisan free market quasi-consensus by imposing tariffs on various goods from China and other countries. Here's a clip of Biden speaking at the announcement.
Steel and aluminum, semiconductors, electric vehicles, solar panels, the industries of the future, and even critical health equipment like gloves and masks. China heavily subsidized all these products, pushing Chinese companies to produce far more than the rest of the world can absorb, and then dumping the excess products onto the market at unfairly low prices, driving other manufacturers around the world out of business. Folks, look, I'm determined that the future of electric vehicles will be made in America by union workers, period.
In a guest post on Impact Alpha, Anil Achuta and Tina Tozakowong of climate tech VC TDK Ventures cautioned that material-intensive clean tech relies on the free trade environment that has prevailed since the end of the Cold War. Yet, we appear to be moving in the opposite direction, with increased fragmentation and deglobalization. David, why do increased trade barriers, like Biden's expanded tariffs on Chinese-made clean energy products, threaten emission reduction goals?
Well, I'm not going to dig into the, you know, economics of it. People should, you know, Google Smith-Hawley Act and that sort of thing. And also, there's a long history to this that's probably not worth rehashing of, you know, America's lost opportunities to dominate these industries themselves. But what I think people are talking about is in climate tech, in solar panels, in wind power, in battery storage, you know, the things that we want to happen have largely happened because of China. So the drastically falling prices of things like solar photovoltaic panels, they've fallen like 85% in costs in the last decade. Batteries, you know, similarly about 87%. Wind power is about 40 or more than 40% cheaper. That's because China went to scale on manufacturing these things and got those benefits to scale. And, you know, what we like to say, what we said in the brief the other day is, you know, Chinese imports may tank U.S. manufacturing, but they could also save the planet. The cost of kind of catching up to China, the increased cost of trying to, you know, onshore those supply chains, according to Wood Mackenzie, which is a kind of a research firm, is something like $6 trillion. And more to the point, beyond the money, is just slowing down this deployment, this great deployment that we've talked about, in large measure depends on cheap Chinese solar panels. So I understand, you know, the politics and the election year exigencies that Biden is facing, but the rollout at an environmental, ecological, you know, climate change level is arguably more important.
And what's interesting is that were Trump to win this election, you know, he would probably end a lot of Biden's industrial policy in some way around increasing the investments from the government in the green economy with the Inflation Reduction Act, but he would certainly probably keep and extend these tariffs.
Well, yeah, because, you know, everybody's out anti-China-ing each other. But what's interesting is, you know, Europe and other countries were crying foul when the U.S. Rolled out the subsidies in the Inflation Reduction Act that were going to advantage U.S. industries in some of these fields. And now the U.S. is crying foul with China. And, you know, at some level, we would rather see a kind of race to the top, not, you know, trying to slow each other down.
Well, there's also an opportunity here, and that's what we always look for here at Impact Alpha. And in the piece, Achuta and Tozakowong argue that as these trade wars heat up, climate investors should really look to back homegrown so-called challenger technologies. Now, David, what do they mean by challenger technologies? And can you walk us through some promising examples?
Well, it's just a kind of an age-old, you know, business strategy, which is if you're down to 3% in a market, you know, maybe don't fight your battle from that small footprint, but change the game and go up market to where there's new technologies, new innovation, you know, the possibility to disrupt something else and then dominate a new market. And arguably, that's what, you know, America, Silicon Valley technology is good at. So they're just saying, you know, don't fight yesterday's battles, but move forward. And the examples they use, you know, the ultimate one, of course, is fusion power and maybe even wave energy, not yet commercial. But a lot of things are really moving up that scale quite quickly towards commercialization, but are not yet dominated by China. So if China dominates lithium ion batteries, you know, maybe North America or the U.S. could get a jump on sodium ion batteries, which are not yet cheaper, but which could become cheaper. And the U.S. is one of the has some of the largest deposits of soda ash, where that sodium carbonate is derived from. Sodium carbonate being to sodium ion what lithium carbonate is to lithium ion. And so there are new battery technologies coming along. There's even a new generation of modular small modular nuclear reactors that are, you know, shed many of the risks of the large ones, you know, that have largely been stalled for decades, but that could power, you know, offsite manufacturing, construction. You know, they have much smaller footprints and lower environmental impact. You know, green ammonia, which has promise in aviation, shipping, long distance trucking, and compressed air energy storage, which turns out to be a possible solution for really, you know, storing energy for the long term, batteries being maybe the short term solution. So move up market, move to the new frontiers, move to the white spaces, as they were, where the global competition is not yet so established.
All right. Well, that sounds like a good playbook. Let's take a break there. And when we come back, we'll discuss what it will take to protect coral reefs and oceans amidst rapid climate change.
I'm Eric Carmen Gonzalez, Impact Alpha's Director of Subscription Growth. Ever feel like there's so much happening it's hard to keep up? We hear you. That's why we created Impact Alpha Latin America, a monthly newsletter for impact investors who want to keep their eye on trends and investments happening in Latin America and the Caribbean. Follow the money and connect with agents of impact powering Latin America's impact economy. Visit our Instagram page at Impact Alpha and click on the link in our bio to sign up.
David, the cornerstone of the ocean economy is coral reefs. These are some of the most diverse and valuable ecosystems that support thousands of underwater species, from young fish to oysters, clams, crabs, and sea urchins. Seafood that billions of people rely on for sustenance and employment. This represents trillions of dollars of value. For years, scientists have been sounding the alarm, with studies foreshadowing the bleaching, death, and collapse of these fragile reefs. And now, global worst-case scenarios are being exceeded. While governments work on efforts to protect continued pollution impacting coral reefs, some impact investors are stepping into the breach. Rudy Sinantis had a Q&A this week with Dale Galvin with the Global Fund for Coral Reefs to talk about his approach to investments which protect vulnerable coral reefs and coastal communities, particularly in the global south. Can you highlight some of what we learned?
Well, Brian, you know, as you said, the situation with the reefs is one of these maybe not so slow rolling environmental calamities. It's a little bit out of sight because it's underwater, but they're essentially the nurseries for most, you know, ocean life and biodiversity and ecosystems. And they're collapsing. Essentially 90% of them are threatened if we hit the 1.5 degree threshold, which we're, you know, hard upon, and essentially all reefs will be dead if at the 2 degrees. So it's a true calamity. The question has been sort of how to invest in their restoration. And this Global Fund for Coral Reefs is an effort to answer that question. And essentially it combines a technical assistance kind of grant fund and then essentially a private equity fund to try to bring private capital to bear on something that has kind of been largely outside of the impact investing world of the private capital world altogether. And they're about a third of the way there to a $750 million goal. So they're not really there yet. There's some interesting catalytic elements to it. The Green Climate Fund has backstopped it with $125 million of first loss capital, that sort of thing. So it's essentially an experiment in innovative and catalytic finance to bring private capital to bear on an immense and urgent environmental challenge.
So can you give me some of the examples of some of what types of investments that they're talking about making in the blue economy?
One that's directly on point is a company called Carbon Wave. And, you know, there's a kind of epidemic or an infiltration of sargassum in the Atlantic in particular. It's this brown algae. It's growing out of control, and it's messing up the ecosystems, also getting tangled in ships and that sort of thing. It also emits, as it decomposes, a lot of methane and other toxic substances. So this company, Carbon Wave, has a method to harvest it, convert it into valuable products, you know, like fertilizers and that sort of thing, and emulsifiers for cosmetics. So you're both taking it out of the ecosystem where it's mucking up the oxygen cycles and things, and turning it into a valuable product, thereby, you know, enabling it to kind of go to scale. So that's, I would say, a pretty direct benefit to the reefs. The other one that they've invested in is a kind of a plastics recycling effort that sets up local plastics recycling to fish, you know, the bottles out of the waterways and things, and make local products. Also good and solid effort. I will say that, you know, many of these are not directly benefiting the reefs. So, you know, I don't know whether the measurement of this fund is literally on sort of reef restoration. What kind of sets it apart as a private equity fund is they are finding industries, big industries, you know, tourism and maritime and fishing, obviously, that can be made to be more sustainable, and therefore, but also already have, you know, revenue streams and customer bases. They're not looking in this case for the kind of bespoke innovative finance, you know, ecosystem services, you know, insurance kind of mechanisms that are developing out there, and that maybe more directly go to reef restoration, but are still considered kind of bespoke and innovative for larger investors. So this is a kind of an attempt to make the ocean economy investable for private equity more broadly.
So this is a blended finance fund. Can you walk us through how it's structured and the management of it?
Well, it's run by a fellow named Dale Galvin, who we've known for many years, back to our days of covering financing fish and the early days of sort of trying to make sustainable fisheries, sustainable seafood, oceans investable. He ran a fund called the Molloy Fund back in 2017 that backed fisheries and agriculture enterprises in Indonesia and the Philippines. Now they've got, as I said, this global fund for coral reefs with a technical assistance fund that's backed by the UN and some member countries, and then this private equity portfolio that's going to make about two dozen or so investments in wild-caught fisheries, aquaculture, hospitality, the so-called circular economy. And they've gotten their first two commercial investors, at least on the commercial terms, the Mindaroo Foundation and then Lucas Walton's Builders Vision, which listeners to this podcast might have been hearing about recently. They're making a big move, and particularly in this oceans economy.
So what are we going to be looking for in the future to kind of track these kind of blue economy investments?
It's interesting, as we've watched this over the 10 years, the number of private equity venture capital funds that are focused on the blue economy has grown from just a handful to more than 30. The money is still in short supply, you know, compared to what's needed. But something called Ocean 14 Capital last week raised more than $217 million for its first fund. This whole category of ocean lens investing, or what some people call the blue economy, has grown up a lot since we were covering it over the last decade. There's something like now, you know, 30 funds, and some of them are starting to raise substantial funds. Last week, something called Ocean 14 Capital announced that it had raised $217 million for its first fund.
All right, thanks for that, David. Let's take a quick break here. When we come back, we'll attempt to bring visibility to the so-called invisible work that women do, and why it matters for both economic growth and climate change.
Every day, Impact Alpha uncovers stories that make a difference to impact investors. I am Zalaima Beeble, Chief Operating Officer at Impact Alpha, here with a special reminder.
Subscribers get the award-winning brief 5 days a week and so much more. Unlock exclusive coverage, get access to subscriber-only calls and Slack channels, plus search hundreds of jobs and internships at the Impact Alpha Career Hub. What are you waiting for? Subscribe today. Learn more at impactalpha.com/subscribe.
Whether you're a policymaker, a regulator, an investor, an academic, a development partner, a representative of civil society, a fund manager, a financial service provider, or an entrepreneur, each one of you has a vital role to play in driving action to close the gender gap in access to finance and promoting a feminist entrepreneurial ecosystem.
That's Rupa Chanda of the UN Economic and Social Commission for Asia and the Pacific, speaking earlier this month at the Feminist Finance Forum held in Bangkok, Thailand. Our own Jessica Pothering attended and filed a compelling report from there. David, what were some of the key takeaways Jessica had?
The biggest takeaway is just the size and scale of this care economy, which is, you know, largely underwater, like an iceberg, in the sense that it's informal and sometimes and often unpaid. And so, just in Asia alone, it's estimated to be worth $3 trillion a year. So worldwide, you know, many multiples of that. And the, I guess the thesis is that if that was sort of made more visible, valued, counted, it would drive a whole set of different kinds of arrangements, both, you know, public policy type arrangements, but also workplace arrangements, also possibly household arrangements, and kind of rebalance, as they say, this kind of care diamond between, you know, between unpaid, mostly women's work, you know, the government and public policy, the market, and then also obviously nonprofits and other kinds of civic society arrangements, but and then also rebalance it between men and women. So if you start working a large number like $3 trillion through a marketplace, you can come up with some interesting new arrangements.
So this gender gap in the care economy, how does that lead to the gender gap in access to finance for women?
Well, it just, you know, once you start, you know, peeling the onion apart, you find that, you know, the fact that women are primarily responsible for, you know, childcare, for elder care, for healthcare, more broadly, you know, has all kinds of ripple effects, keeping them out of the workforce or holding them back from career advancement. Therefore, the employers, and it's not just the lower livelihoods for women, which are well known, but employers are losing valuable talent. And, you know, both actually people leave their jobs because they have care responsibilities, but even, you know, when they're on the job, kind of the psychic toll it takes to be worrying about what's going on back home turns out to be a real productivity killer as well. So governments can get a handle on this by, you know, with more, you know paid child leave, paid maternity leave, paid paternity leave. Even things like universal basic income could be kind of attributed to a way to compensate for that unpaid care, and thus provides a kind of basic livelihood that tends to boost economies from the bottom, and then companies also can take advantage by, you know, thinking through their own human capital policies and providing the kinds of support that make the women in particular, but not only women, you know, men have care responsibilities too, and it's probably about, you know, 2-to-1, but that one is significant as well. So make all their workers be able to have that life work balance that everybody talks about, and particularly in the sense of being able to take care of what are, you know, valuable and valued services, you know, perhaps the most valued, which is, you know, taking care of people you love.
And Jessica also pointed out that this care economy and gender intersects with climate. Can you walk us through how climate and gender intersect?
Well, again, it's one of these multi-layered and multifaceted things. You know, the notion that women are more disproportionately affected by climate calamities and climate costs. I mean, even down to things like the bridges getting washed out, so now the kids can't get to school, or the mothers have to take them across the river somehow to get them to school. So things that are seen as just sort of general climate calamities, you know, tend to have disproportionate impacts on women. And the notion is that thus climate resiliency, not to mention climate mitigation, but certainly climate resiliency also has disproportionate benefits for women. And then if you play that logic out one more step, you'd say that, you know, it's not just sort of, you know, a kind of victimization narrative of women being more hard hit. Because they're closer to the problems, they're also closer to the solutions, as in many cases. And so one of the themes of the conference in Bangkok that you mentioned that Jessica was at was that, you know, the connectedness to communities and the proximity to climate impact positions women as a critical, you know, resource for the solutions.
And one of the most interesting facts that Jessica pointed out in the piece that really blew me away was that women still control less than 2% of invested capital worldwide, whether as asset managers or startup founders. What's your take on that?
Well, this is, you know, this is a running story for Impact Alpha across many fronts, including racial equity lens and gender lens. If more and diverse eyes are on the problem, you know, directing capital in ways that are reflective of people's real lived experience, as they say, then, you know, different kinds of solutions will get funded. So there are a number of, you know, people have woken up to this. Again, if the opportunity is so huge, there are ways to invest in it, or there's increasingly ways to invest in it. So the UN Environmental Program this week launched a debt facility for climate-focused projects and social enterprise, an outfit, IIX, the Impact Investment Exchange that we've known for years, based in Singapore, raised $100 million for its sixth women's livelihood bond, much of which is focused on women's climate adaptation. USAID and Amazon actually launched a climate gender equity fund, trying to raise $60 million for women-led funds in the Global South. So there's, again, a growing, you know, still inadequate, but at least a set of models and pilots and experiments that show the advantage of looking through a gender lens when making climate investments, which is something that we've been emphasizing in our work with Heading for Change. Put a gender lens on your climate investments, and your climate investments will pay off better and be more and deliver more impact.
All right. Well, that sounds like a good place to end it. Thank you so much, David.
Thank you, Brian, as always.
Now, David, what's the best way for people to contact us with feedback?
We love the feedback, and we will receive it from you at podcast@impactalpha.com.
All right. Thank you all so much for listening to This Week in Impact. If you liked what you heard, please subscribe to the podcast wherever you listen and share it with a friend or colleague. If you want to help out, be sure to rate us and give us a review on Apple Podcasts. It really helps other people find the show. This Week in Impact is a production of Impact Alpha and part of the Impact Alpha Podcast Network. For more exclusive stories about the world of impact investing and sustainable finance, join other agents of impact by subscribing to Impact Alpha. Just go to impactalpha.com/subscribe for full access. Thanks, as always, to our producer extraordinaire, Isaac Silk. For David Bank, I'm Brian Walsh, and we'll see you next week for more Impact.